This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This time, it's not what we knew or didn't know about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This time, it's how much U.S. and British intelligence services knew about what was going on in the United Nations Secretary General's office. Last week, a former member of Tony Blair's cabinet, Claire Short, told the BBC that she read transcripts of Kofi Annan's conversations while the Security Council debated Iraq, and that followed the British government's decision to drop charges against a former translator who leaked an American memo asking for British help to bug the offices of other Security Council members. Amid the official outrage at these revelations, former intelligence professionals wearily remind us that this sort of thing is nothing new, while retired diplomats say they've always assumed that the hushed halls of negotiation were echo chambers. If nobody's bugging you, they seem to say, you're not important. We're used to the idea of spying on rivals and potential enemies, but how much effort do we put into spying on allies and on international organizations? And why? Later in the program, we'll ask Congressman Charlie Rangel whether Jean-Bertrand Aristide left the Haitian presidency at the urging of the United States or at gunpoint. But first, espionage, allies, and neutral observers. If you have questions about who the United States spies on and why, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, currently the CEO of Berg Associates. Nice of you to come in.
Hi, Neil.
Bugging the UN, should we be surprised?
Absolutely not. This is sort of reminiscent of the line out of Casablanca when the police inspector is just shocked to discover that there's gambling going on in Casablanca. We're taught early on in the intelligence community that there's no such thing as a friendly intelligence service. And the purpose of intelligence organizations are to collect information for your government. And if people are giving it up willingly, that's fine. You don't need the intelligence. But if they're trying to protect their conversations or hold them in private, you want to get access to that information. So in this case, absolutely no surprise.
What would be the payoff of knowing who Kofi Annan was talking to and what they were talking about?
You'd want to find out if Kofi was telling you one thing in your private discussions and then saying another thing in public and then actually plotting in secret with some other folks to sandbag you. We have seen that in the past and some other issues. You know, it's like wanting to play poker, only you want to know what the other guy's cards are before you put your money on the table.
And is spying, and you know, we accept it if you want to know, has the 7th Division moved up to the border? That's everybody's pretty clear on that. But what's the role of spying in diplomacy?
Well, the role of spying in diplomacy is to figure out what the diplomatic positions of other people are. Let me give you a specific example. Back during the war in Central America, for example, there was a Central American peace process being advanced by the government of Costa Rica. And what the United States wanted to know was, how many other countries in the region were willing to support that initiative? And we had several cases in which the presidents of those countries would tell U.S. diplomats one thing, but then through other means we would find out that they were giving the exact opposite message, and when push came to shove, they did the opposite of what they told us they were going to do. So finding out in advance that someone's going to perhaps leave you out on a limb.
So how do you actually go about eavesdropping on somebody at the United States, at the United Nations, rather? Is this a question of wiretaps or planting a microphone in somebody's office?
Actually, what I found disconcerting about this was the United States felt the need to go ask the Brits to help us out. So it would suggest that our own capability has fallen woefully short. You can do everything from recruiting somebody inside Kofi Annan's office to be your eyes and ears there, as well as planning listening devices, intercepting telephone calls, whether wireless or hardline. You know, there's a whole host of things that you can do that, you know, I guess it strikes me that it's sort of funny that people are amazed that this is being done.
Would you assume, if you were still in the business, that not just the United States and the British, but the Russians, the Chinese, the French, all had similar kinds of equipment in the UN Secretary General's office?
Absolutely. You know, it would look like a fire sale at Kmart or something with the different people struggling to get in there and get access. What is sort of humorous about this is the fact that the countries like the Chinese and the Russians, who have their own very robust intelligence services, get to sit back and say, oh, this is terrible. How dare they do such a thing?
The other aspect of this is, you know, I guess it's an open secret at that point.
Well, the problem is when it becomes public like this, then you've got a problem because you eliminate plausible deniability and you look stupid.
Another thing that happens, Richard Butler, the former UN weapons inspector, was saying, yes, he assumed that all of his conversations in his office at the United Nations were being recorded or accessed by other people. And any time he had a serious conversation that he wanted to have with somebody, or a sensitive one, he went for a walk in Central Park.
Exactly right. I'm familiar with a situation here in the last couple of years with one of our great friends, the Poles. Where they were bugging hotel rooms of U.S. people that were over there working in a joint exercise with the Polish government. They had it wired for sound. So, you know, film, you know, everything from video technology to audio technology. So the whole works.
So presumably the stuff left over from the old communist government.
Well, old habits are tough to rub out.
What would be their purpose in this? Again, are they trying to turn an American?
That's one possibility. Again, within this, you want to get access to information. And if your target is, even if it's a friendly country, and we saw that in the case of the United States and Israel. Israel is our great friend, but Israel had no hesitation about recruiting Jonathan Pollard to pass them information to find out what the United States was going to do. From the standpoint of the Israelis, I understand it. They depend upon us as a part of their security blanket. They need our money. They want to find out if we're going to change our policies. So they need to find out. But our goal is to catch them.
And though everybody says it's an open secret, everybody does it, we shouldn't be really surprised. The person in question, Jonathan Pollard, is, I'm not sure we're going to live long enough to see him emerge from prison.
And, you know, he played the game, he got caught, and he's getting what he deserves. Just because it may be an open secret, or at least an assumption that it's taking place, doesn't mean that it's not a serious breach of trust. And that's the spy game is a double-edged sword. From the standpoint of the United States, when we recruit assets or find ways to penetrate governments overseas, it's a heroic effort. When someone does it to us, they're a traitor. And that's just how the thing works.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst who's now CEO of Berg Associates. And Marin joins us from Rochester, New York.
Actually, sir, I'm in Rochester, Minnesota.
I apologize. Go ahead.
That's all right, sir. Well, thank you for taking my call. I wholeheartedly agree with your guest's remark. I think he is very eloquently put. There used to be an old saying in the intelligence community that in God we trust, everyone else we monitor. And I think this kind of applies to the situation. Because like your guest mentioned, there is no such thing as a friendly intelligence organization. Each of these units, wherever they are, whichever country they represent, are collecting information on behalf of their own nation, and that's how the game is played.
Let me ask you about that, Larry Johnson. Is the British and the Americans have been extremely close. Certainly, there have been tensions at various times during the years, but on a lot of subjects, they do seem to share a great deal of intelligence.
That is true. They're sharing, and that's called liaison intelligence. And as you recall, George Tenet's speech before the Georgetown University about 3 weeks ago cited liaison intelligence as one of the major flaws in our intelligence collection prior to the Gulf War. In other words, when a foreign intelligence service is giving you information, you need the instincts of a journalist, because journalists always wonder, why is someone telling me this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's their angle? What do they hope to get out of it?
Qui bono, yes.
Absolutely. You've got to have the same attitude in this intelligence information that comes to you, whether it's a source you've recruited or it's a, quote, friendly intelligence service that says, hey, let us give you this information.
By the way, Marin, thanks very much for the call. Sorry I misplaced you in your state.
That's quite all right, sir. Thank you for taking it.
If you intercept a conversation in Kofi Annan's office, though, don't you assume that he assumes he's being recorded, that everybody knows what's going on?
You can assume that, but unless you may find out through the intercepts that you know for certain that that's taking place. But it's always better to, with multiple sources of intelligence, not to just pin it on one conversation or one human asset. You can use a variety of intelligence sources to corroborate information.
There is a question that we also have to ask, and that is about the legality of all of this activity. Of course, an organization like the UN, international law, has something to say on this subject. Joining us now to talk about that is Ian Johnston, Assistant Professor of International Law with the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's with us from his office there in Medford, Massachusetts, and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what is the law regarding espionage at the United Nations?
Well, there is some law, and the starting point for it is the UN Charter itself, in fact, which says that UN officials are entitled to the privileges and immunities necessary for them to carry out their functions. And that those privileges and immunities have been elaborated in a treaty. There's something called the Convention on Privileges and Immunities of the UN. And it does spell out some provisions, some rights, some privileges that UN officials have. It protects UN premises. It says that those premises should be free from any kind of interference. It says official communications should be given the same treatment as official communications of any diplomat. And so while there's no explicit reference to bugging or wiretapping, it seems pretty clear that if you add all of this up, electronic surveillance is illegal.
Let's get a listener's question on this. Roberta joins us from Williamsburg, Virginia.
Hi, hello.
Hi.
I wanted to find out a couple of things. Is this actually an international crime? If it is, why isn't there an international group of inspectors that make sure that this doesn't happen? And if someone is caught, whether it's an individual or a country, who prosecutes them?
Ian Johnston?
Well, it's not an international crime. Crime is a rather specialized term in international law, and it refers to imposing criminal responsibility on individuals for actions they take. And so there's nothing in the international law which would make this a crime. It's an international legal obligation that's on states, and therefore states are the ones who are required to comply with these obligations. So there really isn't an issue here of international prosecution of anybody for any violation of the law. If there's prosecution that's going to take place, it would have to be at the national level, and it would have to be on the basis of violations of national law.
Why isn't there something set up for this, since so many important things happen at the UN?
Well, the political will it would take to generate a treaty or a legal obligation which would impose criminal responsibility for something like this simply isn't there. And I'm not sure anybody thinks it's really necessary. The legal obligations that do exist rarely become the subject of political and public dispute, and when they do, normally these things are dealt with through diplomatic channels rather than through some effort to prosecute directly at the international level.
Roberta,
looks like it's not working.
that's sort of my next question, Roberta, but thanks very much for the telephone call.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Just one quick question, Larry Johnson.
Sure.
The Secretary General does have his own counterintelligence staff that's supposed to be sweeping
right.
the offices for bugs and whatnot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But,
okay.
You know, and I agree with the professor that under the charter, those are protected. But, at the end of the day, we need to know what's going on inside the inner sanctum, as it were.
So that's Roberta's question, Ian Johnston. If there's a law and nobody seems to be paying a whole lot of attention to it and it doesn't seem to be working, what's the point?
Well, it's a good question. But the point here, I think, is that these sorts of allegations don't arise all that often with respect to international organizations. I think in the relations between states, and especially during the Cold War, this was seen as part of the diplomatic game, and it tended not to become public. And while there probably was a good deal of spying, so to speak, that went on during the Cold War years in the UN, it's doubtful that that really had all that much impact on important security decisions that were being taken, because the UN was at the margin of those security decisions through the Cold War. So this is a fairly unusual occurrence. The fact that this has become public at all suggests that maybe there will be some changes, and the fact that this story has gone on for as long as it has gone on suggests that the fact that there are some legal obligations here is not irrelevant. I suspect if there weren't any legal obligations, this would have died 3 or 4 days ago. Everybody would have shrugged and said, well, of course, this happens all the time, and that's the end of the story. But when you can point to some international law and say, well, it may not be a natural part of the diplomatic game, it may not be the end of the story. There's some continuing discourse, there's some continuing back and forth and exchanges between governments and other actors, and the Secretary General makes a statement and whatnot, and hopefully all of this adds up to some kind of change in conduct, at least with respect to the UN.
I should say there was Soviet espionage involved with people at the UN, but they were spying mostly on the United States rather than the UN. Those are the cases that at least became public. But Ian Johnston, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ian Johnston at Tufts University. We'll have more after we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the relationship between espionage and diplomacy and why friendly countries may from time to time spy on each other, or all the time spy on each other. If you have questions about how U.S. intelligence works and its effects on international relations, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And here with us in the studio is former CIA analyst Larry Johnson. If you'd like to join us again, our number is 800-989-8255. Email again, totn@npr.org. And let's take a question from Gregory in San Diego.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been curious as to how great a tool or a target email is for espionage. Is it an effective tool? Is it a target of espionage?
Larry Johnson, do you have information on that?
My understanding is yes. And
yes, it's an effective target or an effective tool?
Yes, it is an effective target and tool. It has it's opened up another front in the intelligence activities, one that devolves to the National Security Agency in particular.
Those are the people, the specific agency tasked to intercept electronic transmissions of all sorts.
They have the giant vacuum cleaner just sucking up everything that's electronically generated.
And this is there's been some controversy over various kinds of U.S. programs that either do or do not, depending on your point of view, offend laws of privacy in gathering this information.
No, you clearly run into a problem with the law of privacy on this, but as we saw with some of the Al-Qaeda activities where they were moving messages back and forth, buried within emails and buried within objects, it suddenly elevated it to a more important priority than many had, 10 years ago, this wasn't an issue.
Mm-hmm. Gregory, thanks. We've been talking about the intelligence side of things. It's the diplomats who operate as the public face for nations involved in these shadowy games. Joining us now is former British diplomat Richard Langhorne. He's currently director for the Center for Global Change and Governance at Rutgers University, and he joins us from their campus in Newark, New Jersey. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello. I should say right at the beginning that I'm not really an ex-British diplomat. I am an academic who writes about diplomacy.
Oh, well.
Though I did work for the British Foreign Office for a short time.
Thanks for the clarification on that. But from your experience, diplomats, do they expect to have their conversations bugged?
Yes. Short answer. but for a very long time, since it has been possible to have things like bugs, all diplomats, whether they are dealing with the diplomatic contacts of friends or international organizations, do expect that there will be a measure of surveillance, yes.
Intelligence and diplomacy are two fairly separate worlds, or at least at times they are. Isn't there a dividing line?
Yes, but this is a genuinely difficult question. It's a genuinely gray area. The formal position certainly is that diplomats are not involved in espionage. Sometimes very senior diplomats, very senior ambassadors, heads of foreign ministries will know about intelligence that has been gathered by the intelligence services. And on the whole, I have to say that I think they generally feel that such intelligence is not always worth a great deal. But they may well have access to it, but they do not generate it. And it's been a very long time since it's been even remotely true that the old jibe, an ambassador is merely a licensed spy, which goes back many centuries. It's been a long time since that was even remotely true.
Despite certain members of diplomatic missions, various attachés of various sorts, are often heads of espionage agencies.
That can be. And part of the gray area is that you can have, within an embassy family, so to speak, people who are not part of the diplomatic service in a strict sense, and whose job is indeed to do with intelligence. And there's one particular character or personage who makes this a difficult matter to discuss, and that is the military attachés. Military attachés, when they are serving as such, they are always military officers, but when they are serving as such, they have the position of diplomats. And, of course, their job is not, in any formal sense, espionage. But since what they have to do is find out as much as they can about the military arrangements of the country in which they are stationed, the line is rather a thin one.
Let's get another caller on the line. And Warren is with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, Neil. It was my understanding that if our intelligence services wanted to eavesdrop or spy on somebody within the borders of the United States, that that is illegal. So they would often ask a foreign intelligence service, such as the British, to do it for them and pass on that information, and vice versa.
Are you talking about spying on American citizens, which is indeed very illegal, or spying on other countries?
Being specific, I don't know, but I guess in a situation like we're talking about, it might be the case.
Larry Johnson?
Well, normally spying in the United States on a U.S. citizen is prohibited unless it goes through a federal court, the FISA process, where they get a warrant and an approval to do so. And in that case, the FBI handles it. Rarely does the Central Intelligence Agency conduct operations within the United States, even against foreigners. That's usually handled by the FBI. But, you know, foreign citizen in the United States, you know, ripe target.
Thanks, Warren.
Thank you.
And let's go to, this will be Sam, and Sam is with us from College Park, Maryland.
Thanks. I think we need to get a little perspective here. As I understand it, the revelations about spying were this British intelligence person, Catherine Gunn, revealed that the U.S. was spying on countries basically to scuttle any efforts for peaceful resolution and to prevent the invasion of Iraq and the ensuing deaths that would arise from that. So this wasn't spying for the sake of it. It was spying in order to drive for war, for aggressive war. And I'm sorry that the...
She didn't leak it to a foreign government. She leaked it to a newspaper.
That's correct. She leaked it to a newspaper, and she leaked it to a newspaper, and the British government was about to prosecute her for and put her in jail for 2 years, and because the British sensibility arose, the British government decided that it didn't want a trial and it didn't want the facts to come out, so they backed... So they backed away. So this, the context of this, and that it's a push for aggressive war, and I'm sorry we lost the legal scholar there, I think is quite pivotal, in particular things like the U.S. scuttling of the International Criminal Court, and other things are relevant. But the point is that that revelation happened before the war, and there was no reporting about it in the U.S. media.
Well, that's
and
not...
I'd like to ask you why you think that is.
I don't think that's accurate. I think the
oh, really?
I think
tell me what media reported the Catherine Gunn revelations prior to the invasion of Iraq. It made headlines in England. It made headlines in all of the countries that were victims of it, whether Mexico or Chile and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What media reported that prominently in the U.S.?
It was reported on National Public Radio, among other, among perhaps not as prominently as you might
you
have
know,
liked.
I'm getting the sense that it's more like National Pentagon Radio. It really is National Pentagon Radio at this point. And I'd encourage people to look at the Internet and get some facts instead of the stuff that you guys are spewing. Right?
Hey, Sam, thanks for listening. As we continue with the conversation, Richard Langhorne, what happens when an ally is revealed to be spying on a friendly nation? Is this, you know, this is definitely going to cause some diplomatic tension, is it not?
Not always. What usually happens is a period of modified embarrassment. I think one can put it that way. Everybody's expectation is that there will be an element of this going on. Now, I guess it's perfectly possible that it is somehow more familiar to the European mind than it might be to the American mind, because the degree of espionage over quite a long period, I mean, going right back into the 19th century, which is as far as you can go talking about effective espionage, between allied states as well as hostile ones, has always been quite clear and quite large in quantity and, perhaps most important, entirely expected. Now, of course, when it comes out, as from time to time it has done, there is an element of embarrassment, but I don't think that it would normally lead to serious tension. Simply because it's an expected activity.
I wonder, has the advent of the European Union, the EU, where borders are being dropped on any number of levels in terms of passage, free passage of trade and people, do you think that's reduced the amount of espionage country to country in Europe or increased it?
No, I think it has probably increased it because it has increased the level of business being carried out both between member states and, importantly, between member states and the central administration in Brussels. And things are happening, therefore, at a larger number of levels. The amount of exchanges are much greater than they would have been or were before the EU existed or certainly existed in its present form. And there have been various outbreaks of the people leaking, whatever phrase you like to use, leaking examples of espionage going on, particularly in and around the institutions in Brussels. I think it has led to an increase.
Richard Langhorn, thanks very much for being with us.
Not at all.
Richard Langhorn is the co-author of The Practice of Diplomacy and director of the Center for Global Change and Governance at Rutgers University, and he joined us from the campus at Rutgers Newark. And let's go on to take another phone call. This is Mike, who's with us from Battle Creek in Michigan.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right.
Good program.
Thank you.
My comment is that all through history, even ancient history, there's been espionage of one kind or another going on. And that just means knowledge, and I think everybody can agree that knowledge equals power. Every country has the responsibility of looking out for its citizens. If that country has the lack of knowledge that could possibly hurt the citizens of that country, then that country has failed in its responsibility towards its citizens. America, Britain, China, Russia, they all had their search for knowledge so that they could have the power to further their ends or at least protect themselves. And that's something that I think will be ongoing forever and is absolutely necessary.
Mike, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And Larry Johnson, I wanted to ask you, there is a question about the motives of the various people involved.
Sure.
The caller mentioned Kathy Gunn, whose motive was to protest a war which she was highly opposed to and leaked it not to another government, which might indeed have been treason under the British law. I'm not sure, but I suspect it might have
right.
been. And this is probably illegal, but as the caller mentioned, clearly the British government did not want the embarrassment of this trial and just decided to drop
right.
the charges. But there are all kinds of motivations for people who do this sort of thing.
Intelligence is just a tool, and how that tool is used, it can be used for good or it can be used for evil. Now, to dispel the notion that the National Public Radio is somehow under the domain and control of Donald Rumsfeld here, that's not the case. But I think he has a point that in this case, I think there's legitimate criticism to be brought both upon the United States and the Great Britain for pursuing information, fearing that Kofi Annan was going to find a peaceful way out of the war in Iraq, which frankly, in my judgment, didn't need to happen and was based upon not erroneous intelligence, but erroneous policy information that policymakers are pushing.
We're speaking with Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. With all the energy the U.S. puts into knowing what other governments are doing, there's also a need to make sure American secrets don't leak out across the border. One company they turn to in that effort is the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies. With us now is Rusty Capps, president of CCSS, a retired FBI supervisory special agent. He's with us from Northern Virginia. Thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome, Neil. Nice to be here.
As I understand it, your center holds classes for government officials on how not to be a victim of foreign intelligence operation. What do you teach them?
Well, actually, that's not what we do at all. We basically teach a wide variety of subjects to both government and private sector companies relating to counterintelligence, both strategic and tactical. We look at how counterintelligence as a discipline is involved in the country since George Washington's time. Everyone knows that George was a great spy master himself and feared other spies and therefore thought counterintelligence was very important. Right up to the present day, but trying to raise people's level of awareness of understanding what you get from counterintelligence.
Give me a for instance.
Well, you know, as you look at where we are today with regard to the war against terrorism. I mean, one of the things we know for sure is every terrorist attack begins with an intelligence collection attack,
mm-hmm.
and if that's true, then counterintelligence is a big part of preempting and disrupting. And terrorist organizations have to collect intelligence on their targets before they decide which ones are going to hit, and then they need to collect more intelligence to decide where the routines are that can be exploited. And then they go back and plan and practice and send their attack teams out and collect at least one more type of intelligence just before the attack occurs, all of those intelligence attacks, all those surveillances, are opportunities for counterintelligence to disrupt the process itself.
So you're teaching people what to look out for?
Well, among other things, yeah. I mean, counterintelligence is, like intelligence, is a very, very old discipline, very complex, requiring practitioners that understand not only the tactics of it, but how it's evolved and what are the lessons of the past, so that the things that we're involved in today come into better focus.
I don't mean to, inquire as to any secrets, but in general, what would be good practice?
Well, I think recognizing, first of all, that the insider threat is the most significant problem any private sector company or government agency faces. If you look at the folks that we've been hurt the most by over the last 100 years or so, you'll find that that the vast majority of them were not recruited by any intelligence service, but chose on their own for various reasons. Back during the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, we were looking at ideological spies. During the more recent period, we began to see a bunch of folks that were doing it for more venal personal reasons. And now with terrorism, we've come full circle again back to ideologues that have a different set of rules and motivations.
I understand you also deal with private companies on the subject of industrial espionage, and I wonder, is that when you're protecting against, are you protecting against foreign governments or private companies?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that if you've got anything to protect at all, you have to protect against both. I mean, there are certainly countries out there that use their intelligence services to collect economic intelligence to benefit their own national industries and national interests, as well as companies that do the same thing. Pretty clear also, as you look at the Economic Espionage Law of 1996 that we passed in this country, that we have recognized that and have got methodologies of dealing with both of those types of collectors of our intellectual property, proprietary information, trade secrets.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
You bet.
Rusty Capps is president of the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies and a retired FBI supervisory special agent. He joined us from Northern Virginia. And we're going to wrap up our conversation on espionage, including espionage on friends and sometimes on neutral observers as well, after we come back from the break. We'll also be joined by Congressman Charlie Rangel to talk about the situation in Haiti. Was President Jean-Bertrand Aristide pushed or did he jump? I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow at this time, a wrap-up of Super Tuesday's results and a look ahead to the next phase in the election season. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're discussing espionage amongst friends and amongst international organizations as well. Our guest is Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, now deputy director of the State Department for CEO of Berg Associates. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Marcos, who's with us from Miami, Florida.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you for the show. My question is, does it make any difference legally or morally if it is the U.S. that was doing the spying or the British doing the spying, in the sense of the U.S. being the host country?
U.S. hosting the United Nations is what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Any difference, Larry Johnson?
No, I don't see any difference there. I think the only issue of morality in spying that should come to play, and this is the responsibility of policymakers, is to decide if the goal is justified. And, again, in this case, I think that point is open to argument, whether, in fact, spying on the U.N. to find out if they were going to be able to put in a peace arrangement. Normally you want to prevent war, not start one.
Marcos, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Before we let you go, do you think that there's going to be any lasting fallout from this? We heard speculation earlier that perhaps there would be more moves on a legal level since this has become public.
Probably not. I think the real damage here is to the prestige and reputation of both the United States and Great Britain, and frankly, with the debacle over what's being touted as the intelligence failure regarding weapons of mass destruction. They've already got a smirch there, so this is an extra smirch.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks,
we appreciate
Neil.
You coming to be with today. You. Larry Johnson, the CEO of Berg Associates, a former CIA analyst.